For the week of May 22nd, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 104, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in London, I'm Michael Giltz.
So you made it to London safely.
Yes, I did. I just got back from the theater at the National. I saw Zoe Wanamaker in The Cherry Orchard.
And pretty good? No good? Don't see it? See it?
Pretty good. I saw it for £12. God bless government subsidies. £12, second row, front and center. Typically 30 or 40 pounds is what that ticket would cost, which is still a lot less than in America. So for what it cost, a terrific bargain. Very good cast. I love Zoe Wanamaker.
And so you even lost some weight. You lost 12 pounds. That's pretty good.
It is about what I lost, actually.
just sitting through the play.
I could lose another 40 pounds.
Good grief. Well, you know, it's funny. When I open the show each week, when we open it, I never know now that we're in the hundreds whether to say 104 or 104.
I think it's easier to say 104, so I think you should say 104.
Then 104 it is. And on today's episode, episode number 104, we will be discussing...
You're proving me wrong with every step.
Right. Well, I'm trying. We'll wrap up our coverage of the Cannes Film Festival, and in doing so, you'll learn why it's not such a good idea to try and make jokes about Nazis. Arnold Schwarzenegger, on the other hand, he had an interesting week, to put it mildly. It looks like music sales are on the upswing, though the sale of physical media, i.e. compact discs, is not. Some additional information leaks out about Ashton Kutcher's deal to replace Charlie Sheen on 2.5 Men. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And as always, from now and into the future, we're going to try and do the worldwide box office for the week. It's the top grossing films from all over the world added up all at once. And this week is a great example of why we should be doing this now and in the future. First, no one else is doing it for you. And second, the number one film at the box office worldwide is Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, which grossed $350 million its opening weekend. That's a ton of money. And more importantly, if we were talking about the U.S. box office only, on Stranger Tides only grossed $90 million. And I put only in quotes there, and we would be debating why it was lower than the last two and how much was in 3D and why this was important or not. The main thing is, if you're Disney, you grossed a third of $1 billion in one weekend, you're doing fine. At number two at the box office is Fast Five with $36.8 million. It's just over $500 million worldwide. At number three is Thor at $24 million. It's just under $400 million worldwide. At number four is Bridesmaids at $20.8 million. It's at $60 million total. It's basically out only in the United States, and it's definitely a word-of-mouth hit and a female equivalent to The Hangover.
You know, I actually was, I've only been back for a couple of days, and I was in the supermarket the other day, and I saw two senior citizens. They were probably in their late 60s, maybe, even mid-70s, and they were talking about Bridesmaids and how they, you know, one had to go, you know, you should definitely have to see it. It's hilarious.
Then you're definitely hitting all four quadrants, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Were they both women?
They were both women, yes.
Well, there you go. It's time we dipped in and saw what it was like. And number five is Rio, the animated film. It grossed $10 million. It's at about $450 million worldwide. And number six is Priest. The first film on this list, I would say, is not a big success. It grossed $9 million. It's at $61 million worldwide, which is about what it costs to make. So they won't lose their shirt, but it's not a success. And number seven is Water for Elephants, starring Robert Pattinson. That grossed $7.3 million. It's at $98 million worldwide. And number eight, also out only in the U.S., is Jumping the Broom at $3.7 million. And number nine, Something Borrowed at $3.5 million. And number 10 and 11 are two films that capitalized on the Cannes Film Festival. They're out in, I believe, France only. The Tree of Life grossed $2.6 million in its first opening weekend. And Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris grossed another $2.5 million. It's at $7.7 million worldwide so far.
Actually, I do have a little correction to that. It turns out that Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, I think it made a $600,000 here in the United States, which is a better...
Oh, that's right. It did.
Yeah, it's a better opening than You'll Meet a Tall, Dark Stranger, which was Woody Allen's last film.
So that should be... The total should be $8.3 million total, I imagine. Was that Woody Allen in the same number of screens as the last movie, or is it equivalent opening?
I didn't even look. I have no idea.
Well, because, you know, if it opened on 100 more screens, then, you know, all that sort of stuff. So Pirates is the big news. You know, a third of $1 billion in one weekend.
Did you think that another film would be the big news this week? I didn't. I thought it was all about Pirates of the Caribbean.
Absolutely. The news about its 3D take is a little confusing. Can you tell us about it?
Okay, so first off, let's just go over the fact that it opened on 18,210 screens overseas, meaning not North America. So when a Hollywood studio says it opened on that many screens overseas, they mean not in North America, U.S. and Canada. That's 100 foreign territories, and it just cleaned up, especially in Russia and Latin America. It made $260.4 million overseas, which beats the worldwide opening of, I guess it was the last Harry Potter movie and the Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince back in 2009.
HP7P1, as we like to call
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know which
No,
film.
I'm sorry. That's the part six, isn't it?
Yeah, I've totally lost track of all Harry Potter.
Well, and those are both five-day weekends, we should clarify.
It beat this Harry Potter movie by $25 million to set a worldwide opening.
International
opening, yes, sorry. But now you wanted to know what the 3D-ism thing was?
Yeah, how's it doing?
Well, 46% of the gross for this past weekend were for 3D presentations. And that
does that include IMAX?
Yes, that does include 256 IMAX 3D venues. And the film opened on 2,747 3D screens, which is pretty big.
That's huge, yeah.
And yet, instead of going up, the 3D take is going down.
Going down from what?
So it used to be that you'd open a film and opening weekend, your 3D take would be about 65% of the gross.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 60%, 58%, somewhere in there. Now it's 46% in North America.
Is that because it's on so many screens?
Well, that's the
I
question.
I mean, it's got a lot more options for people who want to see it in 2D. If 90% of the screens are 3D only, then your chances of seeing it in 2D are very limited. This movie was out pretty wide in 2D, wasn't it?
It was out pretty wide, yeah, in 2D, 3D. Apparently, Thor, more people chose to see it in 2D rather than 3D. Now, that isn't fair because it was a converted film, so they shot it in 2D and then converted it to 3D, whereas Pirates of the Caribbean was shot in 3D.
So it's meant to be seen in 3D in a way.
Correct, yes.
But it's not meant to be seen in IMAX.
Well, no film is really meant to be seen in IMAX unless it's shot in IMAX. And so.
Right. So why my brother and his family went to see Pirates. You know, they said they'd already bought the tickets. I just said, oh, have a great time. I would have said, why? Don't waste your money. It's harder to see the movie. It's not as enjoyable. It gives you more of a headache, especially 3D. It just seems crazy to me that they'd spend a premium for IMAX.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Richard Greenfield of BTIG Research. Now, we've talked about him in the past. He's just not a big fan of 3D, and he now says that American consumers are actually rejecting 3D and that Hollywood's just not listening.
And why does he, what's his basis for that?
Well, he kind of looked at Shrek 4, which I guess opened higher. The 3D take was higher, and it opened the same month a year ago.
Yeah.
And there were fewer 3D screens then. So he's saying, look, your 3D take should only be increasing. The amount of money you're making on 3D should be going up based on the fact that you have more screens that are in 3D. And instead, it's going down.
Well, that's a very vague comparison, just two particular movies that, you know, I would rather see some figures about overall 3D take as a percentage of a movie's entire gross. You know, if we saw last year or the year before that 3D movies would gross, you know, I don't know, 60% of their take overall, you know, add all the movies together, see what percentage of their take came from 3D, and is that going down? I think that's the really only way to tell, don't you think?
Well, I'm going to go back and listen to what you said, and I'll write that up for Celluloid Junkie. Richard Greenfield may have done it for BTIG Research. We'll place a link to that in the show notes because his post had a ton of data in it. But I will go back, and that might be a good Celluloid Junkie post.
Well, great. I'm excited. And, of course, number 10, of course, was The Tree of Life from director Terrence Malick, which we both saw at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm very excited for it opening up in the U.S. It does that, I think, tomorrow. In North America, right?
I don't know whether it's Wednesday or Friday. The 26th.
Oh, no, it's the 27th. It's the 27th, isn't
okay.
it?
I don't know. Yeah, sure. Yes. Oh,
yeah.
Yes
to I both. Think that's right. It opens up this week at some point. It won the Palme d'Or, of course. It was the top prize winner at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm very happy. It was a little polarizing, but it was also extremely well reviewed by a lot of critics. The question is, do Americans care about the Palme? Does it help box office worldwide?
Well, I don't necessarily. I think it probably helps it overseas more than it helps it in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did Steve Zaitchek say at the L.A. Times?
Steve, actually, he had a very good point. He said, really, it's not necessarily the audiences that care about it, but it's the people that write about these movies that care about it, and therefore they will tend to write about a film like Tree of Life because it's won the Palme d'Or rather than other films. However, Movies like Wind That Shakes the Barley and Elephant, both of which won the Palme d'Or in recent years, over the past 10 years, didn't help those films at all, whereas films like Pulp Fiction, Barton Fink, Secrets and Lies, Fahrenheit 9/11, the Palme already helped, although movies like Fahrenheit 9/11 already kind of had, you know, a lot of buzz going around them anyway.
Well, I mean, Fahrenheit premiered at Cannes, so it didn't. It had no buzz until it debuted at Cannes, in a sense.
Well, no, that's not necessarily true, because remember the Weinsteins were in a big fight with Disney over it.
Right, but I mean, nobody'd seen it yet. So,
oh,
I mean,
well, that's, yes, correct, yes,
yeah. I think, of course, Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is a great film, and Elephant are not terribly commercial movies, so I don't think anything would have turned them into box office, you know, giants.
Well, that's putting it mildly. I think you've just kind of understated.
But I do think it's a good argument for the importance of Cannes. You can look at these movies that have been launched from the festival. Certainly Pulp Fiction, you know, that certainly, I think, got a lot of momentum. And I think Steve's point is right, that it wasn't necessarily that people in America said, I want to see that Palme d'Or winner. But it got a lot of press, a lot of attention, just steamrolled through the New York Film Festival, where somebody may or may not have had a heart attack because the movie was so intense. And it just built and built and built. And I think that it is a very good launch pad for a particular type of critic-driven movie.
Yeah, I mean, you liked The Tree of Life.
Oh, yes, very much.
I was kind of indifferent to it. I'm going to see it again, because I would like to see it when I'm not so tired, when it doesn't have the Cannes hype around it. I just want to see it kind of move as a baseline movie-going experience. But that was not the only film to take away a couple of prizes. Actually, it only took away one prize, because now, of course, as you know, Cannes only awards one prize per film.
I think they might. I don't think that's a fast rule. I think there might be two. You can go up to two, I think. They want to avoid years where you have three or sweeping, you know, one film sweeping three awards or something like that.
According to Robert De Niro, he said, no, the festival was very clear that we could only give one prize per film.
Well, Bobby would know.
He knows now, but who knows what it was.
I thought the jury did a very good job, by the way, apportioning out a very, very popular French film, The Artist, won Best Actor. Kirsten Dunst won Best Actress for Lars von Trier's film Melancholia. The Dardenne brothers, who are favorites at the festival, they won runner-up prize with The Kid with a Bike, which tied with a Turkish film by Nuri Bilge Ceylan called Once Upon a Time in Anatolia.
Or as we like to call him, Ceylan.
Yeah, I think it was a very balanced, smart selection of prizes. They weren't what I would personally pick, so I'm not just saying they picked what I liked and therefore I agree with them, but I saw the logic behind what they did. And to add a little cool factor, they gave Drive, the film starring Ryan Gosling, Best Director for Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yes, and they gave, a jury prize to Mae Wynn's police drama, Police.
That's right. She was a French actress turned director, and the European critics liked this movie, I think, in generally a lot more than the American, and it was a nice nod to them.
Yeah, I guess the Americans kind of thought, wait, we've seen this. It's called Law and Order.
So do you think the award to Kirsten Dunst, I thought she gave a very good performance, but the festival had a lot of good female performances this year. Some years it's a little weak. This year it was not. Do you think that was strictly for her performance? Do you think the jury was, you know, making a statement of sorts of solidarity for, hey, Lars von Trier is an artist. He may say stupid things, but let's, you know, focus on the work.
Well, okay. We're kind of jumping ahead, because we didn't really even say what Lars von Trier did over the past 12 days.
Well, I assume our fans are watching us on YouTube, et cetera.
Yes. As a matter of fact, if you want to know what we thought of many of the films at this year's Cannes Film Festival, whether they were in the Director's Fortnight, the Critics Week, or the official competition, you can go to youtube.com/showbizsandbox, and we have a number of posts up going over all of the films. But what wound up happening, I guess it was on Tuesday or Wednesday, Melancholia shows in the morning, and it's an okay film. I mean, it's not great, but it's not one of Lars von Trier's best films. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's not very good.
And it stars Kirsten Dunst. He then does a press conference, at which point he decides to jokingly talk about how he's a Nazi.
But that's not even true.
And that's not even, I'm kind of overstating it. The press ate this up. He was answering a question, and in doing so, remember, English is not his first language, he kind of stumbled over some words and talked about how he could sympathize with Hitler's plight in a bunker being all alone, and how, you know, he was joking around saying that he has Germanic roots, so I guess he's a Nazi. You know, I guess I'm a Nazi. The press ate it up. He was then made persona non grata by the film festival. which
right, it's a controversy that will be forgotten 2 weeks from now, and he'll be back at Cannes, I'm sure, in years to come. It's had more legs than I expected. The Anti-Defamation League spoke out. Other directors felt obliged to comment on it and say, yo, I denounce his remarks. Protégés of his, I think Nicholas Winding Refn is a protégé, right?
Yes. Well, they've actually had a very contentious relationship for years.
Because he's Lars von Trier. So it's had more legs than I expected, but it's really a tempest in a teapot. He didn't say, I am a Nazi. What he said, he was using a slang term that most Dutch use for Germans, which is Nazis. They refer to Germans as Nazis. And in the, if you watch the press conference, which you can find online, he said, I used to think, I thought I was Jewish for many years. He thought he was of Jewish, you know, extraction. He said, but then I found out I'm not. I found out, in fact, I'm a Nazi, meaning German.
Right.
So if anyone would be offended, it would be Germans for, you know, using Nazi as a slang term for anybody from Germany. But in fact, he wasn't saying in no way, shape or form was he endorsing or embracing the hateful fascistic policies of Adolf Hitler.
Right. And he went on to say that in both a press release from the festival that evening. The following day, there was another press release from the festival saying that he had been made persona non grata, which they would not explain what that meant. It meant that he couldn't, his film was still in competition, but he himself as a human being, Lars von Trier, could not enter the Palais des Festivals. So
that's right. It meant that they could slap him on the wrist, but without obligating themselves to stick to some lifetime ban or something like that. It was just like, we're not happy with you, is basically what it meant.
Right. And we knew several people who went in and interviewed him. Many, Stephen Garrett and Dave Bourgeois, all went and spoke with him, and he was very contrite and said, look, you know, it was stupid of me to say stuff like that. I was trying to get a rise out of the journalists, and it just didn't work, and it was just dumb for me to say.
But I like the comment he had later. He said to the New York Times, quotes him as saying, look, I'd actually been drinking quite a lot, but now I'm sober. I would suggest to everybody, don't stop drinking. If I had been, I would be almost asleep at the press conference and would not have said those stupid things. So Lars von Trier says, to avoid saying dumb things, keep drinking.
Yes. Well, you know, he's always been he's always trying to rile up the journalists at large press conferences like that.
Well, it's his job to be entertaining. He just didn't do a very good job this time. Right. Actually, he did. Everybody knew he was joking. They just then cynically used his words and pretended, in fact, he'd said something hateful and vicious when they knew perfectly well he hadn't. And I stick by that comment.
I would agree with that. I think that there were certain media outlets that just really ate this up and actually kind of paraphrased him to make it seem even more vicious than it was.
That's right. I mean, I wasn't at the press conference, and I read news reports, and a number of them said that he had made a joke at the end about his next project would be The Final Solution. I'm like, okay, well, that's a dumb joke.
But then when you watch the videotape, that's not what he said.
Right. In fact, what he said was, I mean, it's a dumb joke in general, but what he said was his next project would be The Final Solution with reporters, meaning let's kill all the journalists.
Right.
So he even made clear it had nothing to do with, you know, Jews. It was a joke about killing all the journalists, which I think ranks right up there with kill all the lawyers as far as popularity goes.
Well, so, you know, this is a guy that shows up to the press conference. He's now has a profanity tattooed across four of his fingers. So
what is the profanity?
Well, it's the F word.
Oh, okay.
And so it's very plain. You can see it. So there's that issue. And, you know, the last time he was in Cannes, it was for Antichrist. He walks into the press conference and there was a journalist there. Both you and I know him, Michael. I'll kind of leave his name out of it.
I know of him. He was featured worldwide. There's no reason not to take his name off.
Ben McBoy. Yeah. He's from the Daily Mail in London, and he's a very nice guy. And he did not like the film, and he lit into Lars von Trier even before he sat down and said, look, you have to explain yourself, sir. And he said, I don't have to explain. You know, Lars von Trier turned around and said, I don't have to explain myself. You're my guests. And he went on to say, I'm the greatest director in the world. And now he was joking the whole time. And I think this was his way of doing the same thing. It just didn't work out as well.
Right. So, well, as you know, I think he'll be back in a year or two at Cannes, certainly. Maybe he'll stop at another festival first. But what about Arnold Schwarzenegger? Will he be back?
Well, do you want to wrap up the Cannes coverage? Or
I thought we had.
Well, we didn't talk about Joseph Seder winning for Footnote.
I don't think I don't want to detail every single award.
Well, that would be the last award that we didn't detail.
No, Camera Door and In Certain Regard and the Critics Week and Directors Fortnight.
Oh, man, we should definitely move on to Arnold Schwarzenegger then. We should definitely move on. So, yeah. So, first of all, we've got Lars von Trier eating up the worldwide press thanks to his comments. And then you have Arnold Schwarzenegger, who decides that now would be a good time, now that he's trying to relaunch his career, to mention that, oh, by the way, I happen to have fathered a child out of wedlock with one of my household employees.
Right. Everybody knows this story. What we're talking about is the analysis in the LA Times about whether this means his career is over. Well, now, what did they say exactly?
They're really looking at whether Schwarzenegger has any options at this point, whether the public will accept him in a new movie or on television or in any entertainment project, or whether he should just kind of slowly fade into history.
And this was a comment by Patrick Goldstein in the LA Times.
Yes.
And what was his decision? Did he think Schwarzenegger was over?
Well, he said, look, you know, his agent said, Brian Lord from Creative Artists Agency once said, once a movie star, always a movie star. You know, he pointed out, well, what about Mel Gibson, Nicolas Cage, Russell Crowe? I know Yogi Berra said it ain't over till it's over, but in showbiz, when it's over for good.
See, I thought his choices were a little bizarre. Are Nicolas Cage and Russell Crowe washed up?
I was a little surprised at those names as well. I think Nicolas Cage, you know, he could come back. Russell Crowe.
I mean, he's got five movies in the can. He's not exactly, you know.
Yeah, his choices may have been bad, but.
Yeah. He's got a movie with Nicole Kidman, a thriller. He's got a goofy comedy with Emma Stone and Ryan Reynolds, who's hot off a big, you know, Green Lantern project. So, and he's got another Ghost Rider sequel, which I'm sure will be junk, but make money. So, you know, he's hardly sitting around. Russell Crowe has had you know, it's been a little while since he's had a really good film, but he just starred in Robin Hood, which didn't do well. But, you know, when you get to launch a big international franchise, even if it doesn't work, you're not exactly, you know, boiled cabbage.
Well, what do you think? I mean, do you think Arnold Schwarzenegger is done?
Absolutely not. I mean, maybe I'm a little confused because I know so many people in the industry were aware of him. I know it's common knowledge in the industry that he's always had trouble with women and sort of sexual harassment and hitting on women, and that he's had that image of a womanizer for decades now. And that's been reported a number of times in the past. I don't care about his private life. Has that not really transferred to the general public? Is this news to them? I mean, fathering a child is one thing. It's, you know, one thing to make a smart aleck comment about a cute woman. It's another thing to father a child, of course. But is this really a big shock to people?
Well, I think it did come as a big shock. As you mentioned, it's one thing to say, oh, yes, he's very flirtatious and he's may have had a fling or two that nobody's writing about or talking about. But it's another thing to say, oh, and by the way, he's fathered a child out of wedlock, completely denied it during his time in political office.
Right. Well, golly, he got away with it. That's amazing. But I mean, really, I mean, not to make light of their personal life, but cheating on your spouse, if that ended showbiz careers, who would have a job in Hollywood?
Well, and if you watched most of the films in Cannes, I mean, they're that very French, like, oh, of course, this is my mistress, this is my wife.
Yeah, he'll be fine in France. He'll be able to have a great career there. Maybe Lars von Trier could come up with a project for him.
Or he could, you know, work with Woody Allen and Jerry Lewis, also beloved in France.
I don't know how much of a career he was going to have anyway. He clearly had interest. He had a number of projects lined up. People definitely wanted to see him back in the saddle. Clearly, he's not going to be the Terminator. He can't play Conan. You know, that franchise is being revived with someone new. I think as a film figure, he certainly still has a viable career to a degree.
Well, we'll certainly see, and time will tell. I just found it interesting that, you know, it used to be you could hide some of these kind of, I don't know what you would call these faux pas.
Personal, you know, imbroglios.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I can't even pronounce that word, but imbroglio.
Imbroglio.
Like that. I just proved myself wrong. I can pronounce it. Now, thanks to, you know, 24/7 news coverage and social media and the Facebook and the Twitter and the.
But he,
I sound like a 70-year-old man. The Facebook.
But he hit
and
it for
Twitter.
His entire time in office.
That's remarkable.
Yeah.
And now you just can't hide stuff like this. It's going to come out one way or the other.
Yeah.
And very publicly. But now, I know we're about to end our movie coverage. Is there anything else you want to say about Cannes? I mean, I thought it was a great year. I thought, you know, the films, there was no really amazing movie, but most of them were quite good.
No, I every year I see at least two or three films that end up on my best of the year list. This year I saw four films. I did think The Tree of Life was amazing. I really liked Le Havre by Aki, not Le Havre. I liked that okay. I really liked The Artist, the French film about an homage to silent Hollywood. I really liked The Kid with a Bike by the Dardenne brothers. And there's one more that I'm forgetting that I really liked. I saw 40 movies. 10 of them I gave 3 stars or 3.5 or 4 stars to. 1 out of every 4 is good to great. That's a terrific ratio. So I had an excellent year.
Yeah, I mean, Drive, I really liked. I know you weren't as keen on it.
Right, a lot of people like Drive.
I like Le Havre by Aki Kaurismäki, the Finnish director, which was actually a French film for him. You know, even kind of the throwaway movies like Beloved were kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was a good year.
Yeah. And you know what? I would say that a lot of our listeners will be able to see some of these movies this year because it was a great year at the market as well, where all the film buyers come and all these distributors acquire all these movies to release all over the world.
That's right. The tourists weren't back. The streets were a little less crowded than usual, but the market and the films and the creativity was definitely in full force at Cannes.
And I'd like to, you know, thank the tourists for not coming, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
Because with the tourists there and all of the festival attendees, you can barely move around certain years.
Sorry, locals, but we're happy they weren't there.
We've got to get to a screening and you're in our way. But, you know, that kind of wraps up our movie coverage and moves us along into some music news. And it looks like music sales are up, according to, well, I don't even know who it is, the Nielsen Company.
Well, they're up according to compared to last year at this time, which, of course, is one of the record lows of the music business for the past 20 years or something, right?
Yeah, they're up 1.6% for 2011. But what they're really saying is, you know, digital album and track sales saw dramatic growth through May of this year. But physical album sales saw a decline year over year from the same period, I guess, in 2010.
Right. People are not buying CDs anymore. They're buying digital albums.
Right. About 16.8% increase for digital albums and a 9.6% increase in sales for digital tracks.
I guess that's because single tracks were already up very high, because I figure that's a huge area that's already grown so much.
Yeah,
people are
true.
Learning more and more to buy albums digitally, where before they were buying singles.
Well, you know, digital retailers, so I guess iTunes and Amazon received, you know, they accounted for more than half of all the music transactions, with a 12.4% increase over last year.
Amazon, of course, carries both digital and physical product.
Yes, correct. But I think they're talking about their digital sales.
And the Beatles came out last year, so catalog sales were up 5.25%, or 5.4%, I should say.
And that they're saying that, you know, it was the Beatles finally being available on iTunes that really led to all this dramatic increase in digital track sales. I don't know if that's true.
No, well, I mean, if catalog sales are up 5.4%, but album sales overall are up 16%, then that's not true. I mean, catalog sales would be up at least, that would be up the most if that was what was driving it. And, one, you know, 13 albums from one artist cannot drive the whole business.
No, but do you think one album from one artist can drive the whole business?
Absolutely.
And I think Amazon believes that. I think Amazon is saying, you know what? Google launched their cloud music service last week. And we have a cloud music service. We want people using our cloud music service. So you know what? We're going to team up with Lady Gaga and sell her new album. I don't even know what it's called, but I bought it for 99 cents.
And this turned out, I think, to be kind of a disaster for them.
I'm a little confused as to why you think it's a disaster. They only sold the digital album for 99 cents. And I think, well, maybe I do know why you're saying that. Is it because it took forever to download?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people had problems. They took a loss on every album sale. They probably lost $7 or $8 or $9 per album to sell it at this discounted rate, because they had to pay $8, $9, or $10 for the album themselves. They turned around and sold it to us for $1. That means they lost at least $7 on every album that they sold. And the whole point was to get people registered and using their cloud music service, where you can listen to music anywhere you want on any device, and it's kept and stored in the cloud. But what happened was people tried to download the album and they sort of crashed. They took hours. They took all day. They couldn't even get it done. And Amazon, A, wasn't prepared for the crush of demand, and B, didn't do a very good job with PR. They basically just sent out a tweet at one point saying, yeah, things are going really slow, don't worry.
Well, and actually that's true and not true, because when I went to their website to buy it, because I bought it pretty late in the game, they did say, hey, if you buy it today, you will get this price. It may not download immediately, but you will get this price.
But how much of a selling point is that for their service if you can't even download the – you got to wait a day to get the album? Is that going to give you confidence that you can listen to your music whenever you want? To me, it would make me say, gee, their cloud service just have a problem a few weeks ago? Amazon's digital cloud stuff? Yeah, now I'm trying to download the album. I got to wait a day?
Well, this remember, when clouds are in the sky, it does rain.
it just was not handled very well technically. You don't want to have this sort of snafu.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think people always tend to overestimate the technology, and the cloud is really proving that to be true.
Yeah. And of course, Lady Gaga is a huge star. I mean, what does it mean to sell an album by the biggest pop star in the world at the moment for a buck?
Well, it means that people like me who would have no intention whatsoever of buying this album went out and bought it.
That's true. But what does that do in general to devalue the music and make people expect, you know, $4 albums, $1 albums? You know, does it really hurt the business overall? I mean, you're not selling a new artist for a buck. You're selling the biggest pop star in the world at the moment.
Well, you know, Bon Iver, I know some people call
Bon Iver.
Bon Iver. I have pronounced it in all sorts of ways.
I don't even really know either.
Bon Iver, Bon Iver, great, great band. This artist, this band has a new album coming out. They released a single by accident. iTunes, for the first couple thousand of sales, sold the entire album. They had the whole album posted to iTunes.
And so they were ready for it.
Yeah. The people, rather than just downloading the song, they went and purchased the entire album. Now, they paid for the entire album, but still, the album isn't out until the middle of June, maybe even July.
It is now.
Yeah, well, it immediately hit BitTorrent and all of these pirate sites, so it's leaked, effectively. And there are some people saying, well, did it leak on purpose, or did it leak because of a mistake? Because that might have been a way to kind of get some buzz around the album. Because once the album is out, it is so easily replicated and duplicated and sent all over the world thanks to BitTorrent and other technologies. The fact that people are willing to pay anything, whether it be $5, $4, $7, $1, is good.
Yeah, that is great. And that leads into a study by Merlin, which is a digital rights agency, and they represent a lot of independent labels.
Actually, they only represent independent labels, really.
I wouldn't know. I'm sure you're right. They published a report saying, looking at the indie sector and how it did in 2010, and they're saying that when you look at the sales of indie artists, they're doing better in digital than they are in physical, which is, I guess, true for everyone, but it seems to be more pronounced for them. And the message that they take away from this is that now that we have this digital world where an artist like Bon Iver and one of my favorites, the tallest man on earth or tallest man on the world,
the tallest man on earth, and he's a great, great, I think he's from Sweden, I want to say.
Yeah, he's like Swedish, and he's sort of like a Bob Dylan-esque folky.
Oh, so good. His albums are so good.
They are terrific, and you have people like this with very small budgets, a very small profile, but because they're easily accessible. Just, you know, they're as easy to buy as the new Rolling Stones album. You don't have to import a CD from Sweden. You don't have to wait 6 months to get an album. It's all available at the same time, and when everything's available at the same time, people are more adventurous. There are more albums to find more easily, and they're buying Bon Iver, and they're buying The Tallest Man on Earth, and they're buying Lady Gaga, sure. But indie artists are really benefiting from the fact that it's sort of a level playing field when you get into the digital arena.
Right, and I think that they've kind of made it a latte decision, where it's like, oh, it's $4, I'll buy it. And I'm really surprised that, why am I forgetting? Mumford & Sons. I almost forgot their name there.
That's still in the top 10 practically, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but Amazon is selling their album for $5. And it's a relatively new album. The album's a year old. And you know what? For $5, you just buy it. You buy the whole album.
Exactly. But that's such a great thing. I do feel like I don't want to devalue artists' work. I don't want them to have to only make money on tour. But, you know, $4, when Amazon had a whole string of albums available every week for $4 or $5, which I think they've backed off from, I was buying a lot more music than I had been.
Well, actually, they've only increased the number of $5 albums. Most of them are catalogs.
Yeah, but no, I'm talking about every new release for about 6 months. They had, boom, it was there available for $5. And that really had me buying a lot of new albums that I wouldn't have otherwise. It's where I'm willing to pull the trigger, and it's so convenient and easy. And Mumford & Sons is at number 12 right now on the Billboard charts, so it's great to see.
Well, now every time I go to my Amazon Cloud Music player, I get to see that Lady Gaga record cover, that wacky record cover. But, you know, Merlin is saying 57% of the U.S. album sales are indie. They come from the indie sector.
They're saying 50% of all sales
That overall market share of the independent sector when it comes to U.S. albums is 50% greater in the digital domain than in brick-and-mortar stores. I totally botched that whole...
That's a very confusing stat anyway. But they're doing very well in the digital realm.
Yes, effectively. Cool. That's what I was trying to say when I first started talking.
So you see Lady Gaga's album cover whenever you go online for that. And soon you'll be seeing Ashton Kutcher's on the cover of every magazine when he lands on 2.5 Men in the fall.
Wait a minute. He's not on the cover of every magazine now?
Not as much.
Okay. Well, I know he's He does seem to be everywhere.
He's got a big new project to push.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's not new. It's kind of his new project.
Right. So what did we learn new? I feel like there's some new information in a Wall Street Journal article, but I felt like it really just confirms what we suspected or reported earlier.
Yeah, we kind of guessed right. Lauren Sugar of the Wall Street Journal said that he only signed a one-year contract to appear in Two and a Half Men.
That's new to me.
Yeah, that is new. Warner Brothers and CBS, Warner Brothers producing the show, CBS airing it, they want to try and get 2 to 3 more years out of this show. And they're going to be paying Kutcher $20 million for the season, which works out to about $750,000 per episode.
Now, is a lot of money.
Yes, that is a lot of money. Sheen was being paid $1.2 million per episode, but he had a lot of back end, which brought it up to about $1.7 million.
And that's probably the most for any sitcom star right now. The people on Big Bang Theory aren't making that much. They're making a very good amount of money, but that's probably the biggest amount.
Yeah, and everybody's waiting with bated breath to see how they handle the transition from Sheen to Kutcher in the first couple of episodes.
But $750,000 is not exactly a bargain rate. That's top dollar for a sitcom star.
That is absolutely true. I mean, it's kind of a big deal.
Oh, and I'm not quite done with this. I think it's a surprise. I assume that they'd have a clause. They sign him for 1 year and they have the right to pick him up for a second year. But they seem to be implying that, no, it's strictly a one-year deal.
Yes. Well, I think he only wanted to sign a one-year deal.
Normally, you can't be on a sitcom unless you commit to 5 years going in. Even a big star, they're not going to launch a show around you unless you commit to basically a run that will give them enough to make big bucks if it's a hit.
That's why you always see those the shows that are quite successful. You'll see Everybody Loves Raymond, 4 years in, all the stars
will renegotiate.
They want raises because they're locked into these 4 year. These four-year deals up front.
Or five-year deals. Well, and they do it sooner and sooner. The Big Bang Theory people came back and said, look, they knew this was the time. They'd moved to Thursday at 8, and they renegotiated renegotiated to up their salary. And the studio did it. They could have played hardball and said, no, you have your contract. But they know that, they've got to give them their payday. And it's to everyone's interest to keep everybody happy.
Exactly.
But what I don't understand is the figures. I know it's their number one sitcom, but I'm not sure why CBS and Warner Brothers want to keep it going for another 3 years. They already have so many episodes for the show. There tend to be a decreasing value in more and more episodes. Once you've got over 100 and they've got hundreds, it's not worth your money anymore.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure either why they want another 3 years. That's a good question. I couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, I guess it's just a question of needing an anchor. And CBS is a very strong network. They have a lot of hit shows.
And they already have 7 years of shows banked, so...
Right. But I'm saying they're also in very strong shape. It's not like NBC, which is afraid to give up The Office because they're in such terrible shape, even though that's not even really a hit. It's a demo hit, but it's not a big hit. And yet they're frightened to let it go because they have nothing. CBS has a ton of shows.
Hey, I don't know. Call Les Moonves.
Okay.
Find out.
If you answered my call, that would be a big deal.
Well, yes, that would be a big deal. And as I tried to move us along earlier into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them, our first story is going back to music. Apple is really and truly ready to launch its cloud music service, according to numerous sources. They have a deal with EMI and should nail down the other three major labels by early June. iCloud will probably be announced on June 6th during one of their conferences, which is actually known as the Worldwide Developer Conference, WWDC. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because I want there to be competition because the service Amazon offers is too expensive for me. I've got, 100,000 tracks. So I want somebody to offer me a deal that makes it worth my while.
So now just to clarify, it's not too expensive track-wise. That's the same amount of money to buy a song there as it is on iTunes. In fact, it's cheaper, but it's too expensive to store all your music there.
Well, that's what the service is, isn't it? It's a storage service.
Yes, but of course, they look at it as, yes, it's a storage service. However, really, we want you buying stuff from us.
Well, it's an extension of iTunes, but right. They want to make the music you buy on iTunes more valuable to you by saying you can listen to it on your phone, everything on your phone, not just whatever the limit of your phone capacity is. You can listen to every song you own. You can listen to every song you own on your laptop, on your home. You don't have to import it and carry it around with you. It's all available all the time.
And you want to know why all of those ISP, those internet service providers like AT&T and Verizon, and
putting on their caps.
Yeah. Why do you think they're putting those caps on? Because they know that as soon as all of this cloud technology takes off, that you're going to be streaming your entire life. Networks are going to be dragged down. Just watch. Just wait. You'll see there'll be a big kerfuffle about that. I love that word, kerfuffle.
And you should fight them tooth and nail. They need to improve their networks. And the company that offers me No Limit, that's the one I'm going to.
Amazon, which alongside Barnes & Noble is the biggest bookseller in the country, now sells more ebooks than physical books. To be specific, they sell more copies of ebooks in total than all copies of hardcover and paperback combined.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We knew this day was going to show up at some point. But did we think it would come this fast? The facts pile on. Ebook sales were up 159% in the first quarter compared to last year for 9 major publishers. In contrast, print segments as a whole dropped 23%. More ebooks are now sold than mass market paperbacks. Is all this news for the ebook a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a huge big deal. It's happened for Amazon and will happen for the industry overall probably sooner than we expect. Barnes & Noble just released a new mini Nook, you know, just like the Amazon Kindle. That's sort of a less expensive version. It has a battery power that will last 2 months. I think we're seeing a range of tablets and e-reader devices. This is not the wave of the future. This is now the present.
I know. You know, it's funny. I get Wired Magazine on paper, and I can't wait until they allow me to download it on the iPad. Likewise, I might subscribe to The New Yorker just because I can get it on the iPad.
I was just at a bookstore at the National Theater on the South Bank in London, and there was a new biography by Stephen Fry, which is not available in the U.S., or at least I didn't notice it. It was in paperback. It came out last year. It's £7, and I just didn't buy it because I'm like, I don't want to lug that.
Right, exactly.
I'd rather have it on ebook.
That's exactly right. I'd rather be able to carry 40 books with me in the palm of my hand. Dick Ebersol, the guy who helped launch Saturday Night Live and has overseen NBC's sports programming for decades, has left the network. He butted heads with new management. Ebersol's used to spending what he wants to get the Olympics. Comcast, their NBC's new owner, just wants to make money and prestige be damned. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big ending of an era, that's for sure. Dick Ebersol is a huge figure in television. I mean, he helped launch Saturday Night Live, so many different sports programming, and the Olympics. He's always spent big and basically won big. And for decades, the Olympics have always made money. It's just the last one or two that did not make money. And Comcast said, we're not doing that anymore. You know, we don't care what the tradition is at the network. We're just going to make money. It's kind of a shock for me to see him go. He's just been such a fixture for so many years. It'd be like seeing Bob Costas not host the Olympics.
Right, you know? Exactly. Well, yeah, someday that will be the case.
Bob Costas, I've always felt so bad. He's on a network that has almost no sports programming. He's literally trapped at the worst possible network for him. It's really a disaster, I think, because he's such a good broadcaster.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who listened to him growing up. And by what I mean by growing up, he was growing up on the radio in St. Louis, and he was just a whiz kid with all the facts and figures for baseball and football statistics.
He was a walking, you know, baseball
encyclopedia.
Analytics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mannix is on the case. Actor Mike Connors starred as tough-as-nails detective Mannix for 8 seasons from 1967 to 1975. It's been syndicated worldwide, at least the show has, not the actor, and of course, sold on video and DVD. And yet, though Connors was supposed to share 20% of the net profits from later seasons, he says in a lawsuit against CBS and Paramount that he has never received a penny for the show in residuals, and that somehow, even though the series ended production 36 years ago, it somehow keeps sinking deeper and deeper into debt. Connors insists the accounting techniques and original contract were fraudulent and designed specifically to prevent him from ever seeing any money. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's amazing how so many older contracts are coming back now, you know, like the M&M deal with residuals versus sales and licensing versus sales, and artists coming back to companies going, you know what, you owe me a lot more money, or saying, you know what, this gentleman's agreement that net profits don't count, I'm sorry, it's a joke. You know, the show's been out of production for 36 years and it keeps going, losing more and more money as they sell it in syndication and sell it on DVD. It's just ridiculous.
Well, you know, I agree. More and more, and I don't mean to interrupt you there, I think it's kind of the difference between an analog world and a digital world. In an analog world, you had 10 million people watch your show. In a digital world, you had 6,238,452 people watch your show. And I think it's a lot harder now to hide all of these facts and figures.
That's right, though. That's why studios don't ever want to release DVD sales info. They're very wary of it because they know people will say, oh, my God, you're making all that money. Where's my cut?
Right, exactly.
they, they've hidden that info for years, and you just can't get away with it. Not when it's a streaming and all this, and people can track it a lot more easily.
Lady Gaga's fans are gaga over her success online. They've turned Lady Gaga into the first tweeter to boast over 10 million followers. Many of her posts are responses to fan comments and questions, like this one in response to a question about sweets, presumably. I like bitter, dark chocolate desserts. Info on a new single being available and jokes like, my water just broke. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's what you got to do, especially if you want to be a star on that level. People keep saying, aren't you bored? Why are you following Ashton Kutcher? Why are you following Lady Gaga? Who cares what they say? But you know, when you're not in the business and you don't get a chance to interview people, you know, it's fun to get an email that's from Ashton Kutcher that he wrote on a spur of the moment 2 seconds ago.
Right.
So the more they feel you, that person actually wrote it and it has their personality, the more fun it is and the more of a connection you get with your fans.
And that connection is invaluable. In fact, we were talking about Bon Iver earlier in the episode. Well, they released their first single the first single off of their new record, but you had to give them your email address and then they sent you a link. Well, guess what? Right. They now have my email address and they will stay in touch. I guarantee it. And that's priceless.
I get that a lot too.
Will tailgating become a thing of the past? A DC era venue, Jiffy Lube Live, what a horrible name for a venue, has announced...
Sounds like a porn site.
Exactly. They've announced a no tailgating policy after 4 fans died in drunk driving accidents over the past 2 years. The parking lot will open later, cops will patrol, tickets will be stamped, no tailgating, and so on. Guess Jimmy Buffett is going to have to find himself a new venue for his annual tour. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I tried to find out more info, so I wish I knew whether the fans who were in these sad, tragic accidents actually had been tailgating or the drivers have been tailgating. You know, is there an actual link between this? Some people say, hey, if you can linger before and after a show, you're more or less likely to be drunk. Or if you can't drink in the parking lot, then you'll drink before you go to the show and therefore show up drunk and be driving, you know. I don't think this is some sort of cure-all for preventing drunk driving, you know. Don't allow drunk driving. I don't know. People can tailgate responsibility. That's part of drinking responsibility. So I don't quite like this.
YouTube is getting into the music chart business. Like several other companies looking to track online popularity for music, YouTube is launching a weekly YouTube 100 listing, the top music videos on its site based on plays, user upload info, viral debuts, and more. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I'm going to say it's a big whoop because I tried to find this list at YouTube where they told me to go and I can't find it. It's the YouTube 100. I get it. The top 100 music related clips of the week, or I guess it's ongoing, constantly updated. I don't know. But I found where they sent me. I found all sorts of different genres and categories. I could start playing songs, but I never saw the list. I wanted to look through and see what was number 1, number 10, number 100, and I couldn't do it. So if they're not presenting it that well and I wasted 10 minutes trying to figure it out, I say big whoop.
Well, at some point it'll be a little bit more prominent maybe.
Well, but if they're launching it, they should do a better job.
Well, their whole thing, they Katy Perry and, you know, who everybody knows Katy Perry, is right up there with Rebecca Black.
Well, that's one of the biggest
I should say that the reverse way around. Rebecca Black is up there with Katy Perry.
Right, but of course she is. I mean, it's that I don't know if that song is still in the top 10 or where it ranks, but it certainly was one of the big YouTube hits of the past year. So, of course, it should be.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know about this week, but...
Of course, she sang the viral hit Friday, Rebecca Black.
Viral?
Yeah, it was very viral.
Oh, she sang the viral hit Friday. Yeah, yes. She sang the pop song Friday. Yeah.
Speaking of singing, how soon will it be before the duo Eli Nicky? Is that how you pronounce that?
I think so.
Well, how soon will it be before they make it into the YouTube 100? They're the group from Azerbaijan that just won the Eurovision Song Contest. This kitschy European annual event used to be a source of endless silly delight, while occasionally turning up great acts like ABBA or giving a new platform to aging vets like Katrina and the Waves. But mostly, it was a chance to watch tiny European countries and giggle over their crazily campy idea of pop stardom. Azerbaijan won for the first time thanks to Eli Nicky's Running Scared, which presumably is not a cover of the Roy Orbison classic. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because I hadn't watched the Eurovision Song Contest yet. My sister taped it for me. He just spoiled the finale.
I'm so sorry. I didn't know you were interested.
I was really looking forward to that. But I blame the internet. The Eurovision used to be a lot more fun. And in the past few years, when you watch it, Everybody's a lot more professional and cool. They're more on top of things like style and how they do themselves. They don't have crazy ethnic little weird little country centric performances. They all sort of look like the same generic international pop stars. So it's just not as much fun anymore.
Because Azerbaijan won, it turns out that the next year's Eurovision, and I know you'll probably cover this, Michael, will be in Azerbaijan. Because
I'd like to go. That'd be fun. Baku, here we come.
Yes. I guess this year was in Germany because last year Germany won.
Exactly.
Just when you thought I'd never say that name again, it returns. Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, returned to Broadway after a nearly month-long hiatus and grossed a very strong $1.2 million at the box office. That's a far cry from the potential of nearly $2 million it could have earned, but almost definitely covers the weekly running costs, which get higher and higher every time they're reported. The top show is still Wicked at $1.69 million, then The Lion King at $1.64 million, then Spider-Man, and then the $1.1 million for The Book of Mormon, then How to Succeed in Business, and then Priscilla Queen of the Desert, both just over $1 million. And now if you followed that, you win. Is Spider-Man's durability at the box office a big deal or a big what, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It shows that people do want to see the show, and if they can get some sort of good reviews, they can maybe goose the box office and get it up to where they're really making some serious money. But what really shocked me here was The Book of Mormon. This show is such a big hit that, you know, Spider-Man, for example, is running at, what was it, 69%?
64% of capacity.
Right. Big hits like Wicked and Lion King, they're at 108% capacity, which I'm not quite sure how that works. Book of Mormon is running at the highest capacity I've ever seen. It's grossing a capacity of 116%. Are people sitting in laps? Are they sitting in the aisles? Are they on the stage? How are they doing that?
I have no idea, but maybe what they're doing is they're counting standing room because they do sell standing room tickets. And maybe those aren't counted as capacity.
They couldn't have that many more standing room tickets than Lion King and Wicked. And very few Broadway shows actually have standing room. Though I know Book of Mormon does, so I stand corrected there. Because I had a friend who saw it that way, and he said it worked out just fine. So if you can get it, grab it.
That does kind of conclude our Big Deal or Big Whoop segment and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, our segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, just to kind of wrap up Cannes, Miramax was in Cannes, and guess who is a big shareholder in Miramax?
I have no idea.
Rob Lowe, apparently, is...
Rob Lowe?
The Rob Lowe.
He is how can he own shares in Miramax? Aren't they owned by Disney?
I guess he's one of the investors. No. Don't you remember they sold Miramax?
Oh, God, that's right.
My goodness.
My head is spinning. I'm sorry.
We only covered it a million times.
It gets confusing.
Yeah, I know. All those news stories just kind of jumble together after a while.
What kind of piece of the company does he own?
I have no idea, but he's actually taken an active role and is helping pore over all these screenplays that were left behind by Bob and Harvey Weinstein, the former owners of Miramax. When they left Miramax to Disney back in, I guess it was, 2004, 2005, there were all these scripts lying around. And Rob Lowe and Mike Lang, the head of Miramax, are going to turn at least, they say 50 to 75 of the screenplays are makeable.
Does Rob Lowe have a history of producing or directing or something?
No, not at all. Not that I know of. Not really, no.
What kind of stuff is he turning out?
Well, it looks like there's one called The Alibi, which is a comedy written by Stephen Colbert about a service that cleans up messes and creates alibis for the likes of married men caught cheating. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger could probably star,
nice.
Star in that. And there's also a kind of a wedding comedy from the writers of Wedding Crashers. There's one that was written by Anthony Minghella and Sidney Pollack.
Oh, before they collaborated, and I think Pollack produced some of his films, and so they were good friends and worked together a number of times.
Unfortunately, both have since passed on. Yes,
okay. Rob Lowe. I looked, and he only has producing credits on a couple TV shows that he worked on. So I don't want to say it was just a vanity title, but he doesn't have a strong record of producing other films or TV shows, like say Sean Cassidy, who has made a career out of that.
Well, but looks like he's getting involved here.
That's kind of interesting. And Miramax, that's not the only thing Miramax has done lately, is it?
No, they cut a deal with Netflix.
That's right. So, I mean, this is just another example of Netflix building up their library. Miramax has a lot of good titles.
Yeah, like, I think, 600 or 700 titles?
Right. We've seen some competitors to Netflix who announce themselves like foreign film companies or festival companies, and they don't have this many titles at all. And this is just one deal that Netflix has made. They're really dominating in this area.
Yeah, the films will be available in June in this weird rotating basis. That I don't understand. It's like they're going to put some up and then those will go away and then new films will be there. I kind of look at that and go, you know what? No, you got to leave them up. You have to leave them up.
Yeah, if you see a movie there and then you decide you want to watch it and you go there and it's gone, it's very annoying.
Yes. So it's a multi-year deal.
Is this exclusive?
Probably not.
I mean, I would hope not. I would, you know, be stupid to let them have it exclusively at this stage for a catalog.
I would agree with that. And, you know, there's too many other services that are starting.
So Miramax may not be dead and Pretty Boy Rob Lowe may be the one to help them come back.
Well, along with Mike Lang, the head of Miramax, yes. And they hope to even do TV pilots. They say if they do not have several TV pilots in contention for next season, then they haven't done their jobs.
Does Miramax have they don't have a very good track record in TV at all, do they?
Not particularly, no.
I know they were trying for Clerks at one point, but that's a new area. But, you know, that's where a lot of money can be had, so no reason not to try.
I agree.
What kind of budget do they have? Do you have any idea the amount of money they have available? I mean, I think they said something like they want to make 3 movies a year. I mean, 3 movies a year is hardly even worth getting out of bed for.
Well, I mean, if you're Miramax, it most certainly is worth getting out of bed for, especially if you're producing them and own all the rights up front. But they say money is not a problem, that they already have the financing. It's just a matter of picking the right projects, and that's what they're doing.
Why only 3 films a year?
Because, you know, money is not an object when it's 3 films a year. When it's 30 films a year, then money's an object.
Well, at least 12 or 15, I think. Three just seems kind of lazy.
Well, you know, speaking of money being an object, you don't need any money to subscribe to our podcast. You can do that at iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader. You can find links to all of the stories we talked about on today's show on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all of our past episodes or links to our social networking accounts on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. On Twitter, we're Showbiz Sandbox. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can send an email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. You can find them on their website, whoismgmt.com. You can find Michael on his website, michaelgiltz.com. You can find me on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice. Do, 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 do.